Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. This is the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Now, problem is, I've got the sunk cost fallacy going on big time here. I've wasted so much time on hold with the health insurance fascists today. I've got to see this through. I've got to. That's one of the things that I've got to do. So what that means is you're going to listen to Jeff Riggenbach read Murray Rothbard.
Chapter 14, War and Foreign Policy. Isolationism, Left and Right. Isolationism was coined as a smear term to apply to opponents of American entry into World War II. Since the word was often applied through guilt by association to mean pro-Nazi, isolationist took on a right wing as well as a generally negative flavor. If not actively pro-Nazi, isolationists were at the very least narrow-minded ignoramuses, ignorant of the world around them, in contrast to the sophisticated, worldly, caring internationalists who favored American crusading around the globe. In the last decade, of course, anti-war forces have been considered leftists, and interventionists from Lyndon Johnson to Jimmy Carter and their followers have constantly tried to pin the isolationist, or at least neo-isolationist, label on today's left wing. Left or right? During World War I, opponents of the war were bitterly attacked, just as now, as leftists, even though they included in their ranks libertarians and advocates of laissez-faire capitalism. In fact, the major center of opposition to the American war with Spain and the American war to crush the Philippine Rebellion at the turn of the century was laissez-faire liberals, men like the sociologist and economist William Graham Sumner and the Boston merchant Edward Atkinson, who founded the Anti-Imperialist League. Furthermore, Atkinson and Sumner were squarely in the great tradition of the classical English liberals of the 18th and 19th centuries, and in particular such laissez-faire extremists as Richard Cobden and John Bright of the Manchester School. Cobden and Bright took the lead in vigorously opposing every British war and foreign political intervention of their era. And for his pains, Cobden was known not as an isolationist, but as the international man. Until the smear campaign of the late 1930s, opponents of war were considered the true internationalists, men who opposed the aggrandizement of the nation-state and favored peace, free trade, free migration, and peaceful cultural exchanges among peoples of all nations. Foreign intervention is international only in the sense that war is international. Coercion, whether the threat of force or the outright movement of troops, will always cross frontiers between one nation and another. Isolationism has a right-wing sound. Neutralism and peaceful coexistence sound leftish, but their essence is the same. Opposition to war and political intervention between countries. This has been the position of anti-war forces for two centuries, whether they were the classical liberals of the 18th and 19th centuries, the leftists of World War I and the Cold War, or the rightists of World War II. In very few cases have these anti-interventionists favored literal isolation. What they have generally favored is political non-intervention in the affairs of other countries, coupled with economic and cultural internationalism, in the sense of peaceful freedom of trade, investment, and interchange between the citizens of all countries. And this is the essence of the libertarian position as well. Limiting government. Libertarians favor the abolition of all states everywhere, and the provision of legitimate functions now supplied poorly by governments, police, courts, etc., by means of the free market. Libertarians favor liberty as a natural human right and advocate it not only for Americans, but for all peoples. In a purely libertarian world, therefore, there would be no foreign policy, because there would be no states, no governments with a monopoly of coercion over particular territorial areas. But since we live in a world of nation-states, and since this system is hardly likely to disappear in the near future, what is the attitude of libertarians toward foreign policy in the current state-ridden world? Pending the dissolution of states, libertarians desire to limit, to whittle down, the area of government power in all directions and as much as possible. We have already demonstrated how this principle of de-statizing might work in various important domestic problems, where the goal is to push back the role of government and to allow the voluntary and spontaneous energies of free persons full scope through peaceful interaction, notably in the free market economy. In foreign affairs, the goal is the same, to keep government from interfering in the affairs of other governments or other countries. Political isolationism and peaceful coexistence, refraining from acting upon other countries, is then the libertarian counterpart to agitating for laissez-faire policies at home. The idea is to shackle government from acting abroad, just as we try to shackle government at home. Isolationism, or peaceful coexistence, is the foreign policy counterpart of severely limiting government at home. Specifically, the entire land area of the world is now parceled out among various states, and each land area is ruled by a central government with monopoly of violence over that area. In relations between states, then, the libertarian goal is to keep each of these states from extending their violence to other countries, so that each state's tyranny is at least confined to its own bailiwick. For the libertarian is interested in reducing as much as possible the area of state aggression against all private individuals. The only way to do this in international affairs is for the people of each country to pressure their own state to confine its activities to the area it monopolizes, and not to attack other states or aggress against their subjects. In short, the objective of the libertarian is to confine any existing state to as small a degree of invasion of person and property as possible. And this means the total avoidance of war. The people under each state should pressure their respective states not to attack one another, or if a conflict should break out, to withdraw from it as quickly as physically possible. Let us assume for the moment a world with two hypothetical countries, Graustark and Belgravia. Each is ruled by its own state. What happens if the government of Graustark invades the territory of Belgravia? From the libertarian point of view, two evils immediately occur. First, the Graustark army begins to slaughter innocent Belgravian civilians, persons who are not implicated in whatever crimes the Belgravian government might have committed. War, then, is mass murder, and this massive invasion of the right to life, of self-ownership, of numbers of people, is not only a crime, but, for the libertarian, the ultimate crime. Second, since all governments obtain their revenue from the thievery of coercive taxation, any mobilization and launching of troops inevitably involve an increase in tax coercion in Graustark. For both reasons, because interstate wars inevitably involve both mass murder and an increase in tax coercion, the libertarian opposes war. Period. It was not always thus. During the Middle Ages, the scope of wars was far more limited. Before the rise of modern weapons, armaments were so limited that governments could, and often did, strictly confine their violence to the armies of the rival governments. It is true that tax coercion increased, but at least there was no mass murder of the innocents. Not only was firepower low enough to confine violence to the armies of the contending sides, but in the pre-modern era, there was no central nation-state that spoke inevitably in the name of all inhabitants of a given land area. If one set of kings or barons fought another, it was not felt that everyone in the area must be a dedicated partisan. Moreover, instead of mass conscript armies enslaved to their respective rulers, armies were small bands of hired mercenaries. Often a favorite sport for the populace was to observe a battle from the safety of the town ramparts, and war was regarded as something of a sporting match. But with the rise of the centralizing state and of modern weapons of mass destruction, the slaughter of civilians, as well as conscript armies, have become a vital part of interstate warfare. Suppose that despite possible libertarian opposition, war has broken out. Clearly, the libertarian position should be that, so long as the war continues, the scope of assault upon innocent civilians must be diminished as much as possible. Old-fashioned international law had two excellent devices to accomplish this goal: the laws of war and the laws of neutrality, or neutrals' rights. The laws of neutrality were designed to keep any war confined to the warring states themselves, without attacks upon non-warring states, and particularly aggression against the peoples of other nations. Hence the importance of such ancient and now almost forgotten American principles as freedom of the seas, or severe limitations upon the rights of warring states to blockade neutral trade with the enemy country. In short, the libertarian tries to induce neutral states to remain neutral in any interstate conflict, and to induce the warring states to observe fully the rights of neutral citizens. The laws of war, for their part, were designed to limit as much as possible the invasion by warring states of the rights of civilians in their respective countries. As the British jurist F.J.P. Veal put it, "The fundamental principle of this code was that hostilities between civilized peoples must be limited to the armed forces actually engaged. It drew a distinction between combatants and non-combatants by laying down that the sole business of the combatants is to fight each other, and consequently that non-combatants must be excluded from the scope of military operations." In the modified form of prohibiting the bombardment of all cities not in the front line, this rule held in Western European wars in recent centuries until Britain launched the strategic bombing of civilians in World War II. Now, of course, the entire concept is scarcely remembered, since the very nature of modern nuclear warfare rests upon the annihilation of civilians. To return to our hypothetical Graustark and Belgravia, suppose that Graustark has invaded Belgravia, and that a third government, Waldavia, now leaps into the war in order to defend Belgravia against Graustarkian aggression. Is this action...
Those Graustarkians, ain't that always the way? Listen, I'm dealing with the healthcare Nazis at Blue Cross. The fascists. And so... this is Jeff Riggenbach, the heroic Jeff Riggenbach, reading the great Murray Rothbard, chapter 14, War and Foreign Policy, from For a New Liberty.
Here, indeed, is the germ of the pernicious 20th century theory of collective security, the idea that when one government aggresses against another, it is the moral obligation of the other governments of the world to band together to defend the victimized state. There are several fatal flaws in this concept of collective security against aggression. One is that when Waldavia, or any other states, leap into the fray, they are themselves expanding and compounding the extent of the aggression, because they are, one, unjustly slaughtering masses of Graustarkian civilians, and two, increasing tax coercion over Waldavian citizens. Furthermore, three, in this age when states and subjects are closely identifiable, Waldavia is thereby leaving Waldavian civilians open to retaliation by Graustarkian bombers or missiles. Thus, entry into the war by the Waldavian government puts into jeopardy the very lives and properties of Waldavian citizens which the government is supposed to be protecting. Finally, four, conscription enslavement of Waldavian citizens will usually intensify. If this kind of collective security should really be applied on a worldwide scale, with all the Waldavias rushing into every local conflict and escalating them, every local skirmish would soon be raised into a global conflagration. There is another crucial flaw in the collective security concept. The idea of entering a war in order to stop aggression is clearly an analogy from aggression by one individual upon another. Smith is seen to be beating up Jones, aggressing against him. Nearby police then rush to the defense of the victim Jones. They are using police action to stop aggression. It was in pursuit of this myth, for example, that President Truman persisted in referring to American entry into the Korean War as a police action, a collective UN effort to repel aggression. But aggression only makes sense on the individual Smith-Jones level, as does the very term police action. These terms make no sense whatever on an interstate level. First, we have seen that governments entering a war thereby become aggressors themselves against innocent civilians, indeed, become mass murderers. The correct analogy to individual action would be Smith beats up Jones. The police rush in to help Jones, and in the course of trying to apprehend Smith, the police bomb a city block and murder thousands of people, or spray machine gun fire into an innocent crowd. This is a far more accurate analogy, for that is what a warring government does, and in the 20th century it does so on a monumental scale. But any police agency that behaves this way itself becomes a criminal aggressor, often far more so than the original Smith who began the affair. But there is yet another fatal flaw in the analogy with individual aggression. When Smith beats up Jones or steals his property, we can identify Smith as an aggressor upon the personal or property right of his victim. But when the Graustarkian state invades the territory of the Belgravian state, it is impermissible to refer to aggression in an analogous way. For the libertarian, no government has a just claim to any property or sovereignty right in a given territorial area. The Belgravian state's claim to its territory is therefore totally different from Mr. Jones' claim to his property, although the latter might also, on investigation, turn out to be the illegitimate result of theft. No state has any legitimate property. All of its territory is the result of some kind of aggression and violent conquest. Hence, the Graustarkian state's invasion is necessarily a battle between two sets of thieves and aggressors. The only problem is that innocent civilians on both sides are being trampled upon. Aside from this general caveat on governments, the so-called aggressor state often has a quite plausible claim on its victim. Plausible, that is, within the context of the nation-state system. Suppose that Graustark has crossed the Belgravian border because Belgravia had, a century earlier, invaded Graustark and seized its northeastern provinces. The inhabitants of these provinces are culturally, ethnically, and linguistically Graustarkian. Graustark now invades in order to be reunited at last with its fellow Graustarkians. In this situation, by the way, the libertarian, while condemning both governments for making war and killing civilians, would have to side with Graustark as having the more just or the less unjust claim. Let us put it this way. In the unlikely event that the two countries could return to pre-modern warfare with A, weapons limited so that no civilians were injured in their persons or property, B, volunteer rather than conscript armies, and also C, financing by voluntary methods instead of taxation, the libertarian could then, given our context, side unreservedly with Graustark. Of all the recent wars, none has come closer, though not completely so, to satisfying these three criteria for a just war than the Indian War of late 1971 for the liberation of Bangladesh. The government of Pakistan had been created as a last terrible legacy of Imperial Britain to the Indian subcontinent. In particular, the nation of Pakistan consisted of imperial rule by the Punjabis of West Pakistan over the more numerous and productive Bengalis of East Pakistan, and also over the Pathans of the northwest frontier. The Bengalis had long been yearning for independence from their imperial oppressors. In early 1971, Parliament was suspended as a result of Bengali victory in the elections. From then on, Punjabi troops systematically slaughtered the civilian Bengal population. Indian entry into the conflict aided the popular Bengali resistance forces of the Mukti Bahini. While taxes and conscription were, of course, involved, the Indian armies did not use their weapons against Bengali civilians. On the contrary, here was a genuine revolutionary war of the Bengali public against a Punjabi occupying state. Only Punjabi soldiers were on the receiving end of Indian bullets. This example points up another characteristic of warfare, that revolutionary guerrilla war can be far more consistent with libertarian principles than any interstate war. By the very nature of their activities, guerrillas defend the civilian population against the depredations of a state. Hence, guerrillas, inhabiting as they do the same country as the enemy state, cannot use nuclear or other weapons of mass destruction. Further, since guerrillas rely for victory on the support and aid of the civilian population, they must, as a basic part of their strategy, spare civilians from harm and pinpoint their activities solely against the state apparatus and its armed forces. Hence, guerrilla war returns us to the ancient and honorable virtue of pinpointing the enemy and sparing innocent civilians. And guerrillas, as part of their quest for enthusiastic civilian support, often refrain from conscription and taxation and rely on voluntary support for men and materiel. The libertarian qualities of guerrilla warfare reside only on the revolutionary side. For the counter-revolutionary forces of the state, it is quite a different story. While the state cannot go to the length of nuking its own subjects, it does, of necessity, rely primarily on campaigns of mass terror, killing, terrorizing, and rounding up the mass of civilians. Since guerrillas, to be successful, must be supported by the bulk of the population, the state, in order to wage its war, must concentrate on destroying that population, or must herd masses of civilians into concentration camps in order to separate them from their guerrilla allies. This tactic was used by the Spanish general, Butcher Weyler, against the Cuban rebels in the 1890s, was continued by the American troops in the Philippines, and by the British in the Boer War, and continues to be used down to the recent ill-fated strategic Hamlet policy in South Vietnam. The libertarian foreign policy, then, is not a pacifist policy. We do not hold, as do the pacifists, that no individual has the right to use violence in defending himself against violent attack. What we do hold is that no one has the right to conscript, tax, or murder others, or to use violence against others in order to defend himself. Since all states exist and have their being in aggression against their subjects and in the acquiring of their present territory, and since interstate wars slaughter innocent civilians, such wars are always unjust, although some may be more unjust than others. Guerrilla warfare against states at least has the potential for meeting libertarian requirements by pinpointing the guerrilla's battle against state officials and armies, and by their use of voluntary methods to staff and finance their struggle. American Foreign Policy. We have seen that libertarians have as their prime responsibility the focusing on the invasions and aggressions of their own state. The libertarians of Graustark must center their attentions on attempting to limit and whittle down the Graustark state. The Waldavian libertarians must try to check the Waldavian state, and so on. In foreign affairs, the libertarians of every country must press their government to refrain from war and foreign intervention, and to withdraw from any war in which they may be engaged. If for no other reason, then, libertarians in the United States must center their critical attention on the imperial and warlike activities of their own government. But there are still other reasons for libertarians here to focus upon the invasions and foreign interventions of the United States. For empirically, taking the 20th century as a whole, the single most warlike, most interventionist, most imperialist government has been the United States. Such a statement is bound to shock Americans, subject as we have been for decades to intense propaganda by the establishment on the invariable saintliness, peaceful intentions, and devotion to justice of the American government in foreign affairs. The expansionist impulse of the American state began to take increasing hold in the late 19th century, leaping boldly overseas with America's war against Spain, dominating Cuba, grabbing Puerto Rico and the Philippines, and brutally suppressing a Filipino rebellion for independence. The imperial expansion of the United States reached full flower in World War I, when President Woodrow Wilson's leap into the fray prolonged the war and the mass slaughter, and unwittingly bred the grisly devastation that led directly to the Bolshevik triumph in Russia and the Nazi victory in Germany. It was Wilson's particular genius to supply a pietistic and moralistic cloak for a new American policy of worldwide intervention and domination, a policy of trying to mold every country in the American image, suppressing radical or Marxist regimes on the one hand and old-fashioned monarchist governments on the other. It was Woodrow Wilson who was to fix the broad features of American foreign policy for the rest of this century. Almost every succeeding president has considered himself a Wilsonian and followed his policies. It was no accident that both Herbert Hoover and Franklin D. Roosevelt, so long thought of as polar opposites, played important roles in America's first global crusade of World War I, and that both men harked back to their experience in World War I intervention and planning as the guideposts for their future foreign and domestic policies. And it was one of Richard Nixon's first acts as president to place Woodrow Wilson's picture upon his desk. In the name of national self-determination and collective security against aggression, the American government has consistently pursued a goal and a policy of world domination and of the forcible suppression of any rebellion against the status quo anywhere in the world. In the name of combating aggression everywhere, of being the world's policeman, it has itself become a great and continuing aggressor. Anyone who balks at such a description of American policy should simply consider what the typical American reaction is to any domestic or foreign crisis anywhere on the globe, even at some remote site that cannot by any stretch of the imagination be considered a direct or even indirect threat to the lives and security of the American people. The military dictator of Bumblestan is in danger. Perhaps his subjects are tired of being exploited by him and his colleagues. The United States then becomes gravely concerned. Articles by journalists friendly to the State Department or the Pentagon spread the alarm about what might happen to the stability of Bumblestan and its surrounding area if the dictator should be toppled. For it so happens that he is a pro-American or pro-Western dictator. That is, he is one of ours instead of theirs. Millions or even billions of dollars worth of military and economic aid are then rushed by the United States to prop up the Bumblestanny field marshal. If our dictator is saved, then a sigh of relief is heaved, and congratulations are passed around at the saving of our state. The continuing or intensified oppression of the American taxpayer and of the Bumblestanian citizens are, of course, not considered in the equation. Or if it should happen that the Bumblestanny dictator may fall, hysteria might hit the American press and officialdom for the moment. But then, after a while, the American people seemed to be able to live their lives, after losing Bumblestan, about as well as before. Perhaps even better, if it means a few billion less in foreign aid extracted from them to prop up the Bumblestani state. If it is understood and expected, then, that the United States will try to impose its will on every crisis everywhere in the world, then this is clear indication that America is the great interventionary and imperial power. The one place where the United States does not now attempt to work its will is the Soviet Union and the communist countries. But, of course, it has tried to do so in the past. Woodrow Wilson, along with Britain and France, tried for several years to crush Bolshevism in the cradle, with American and Allied troops being sent to Russia to aid the Tsarist white forces in trying to defeat the Reds. After World War II, the United States tried its best to oust the Soviets from Eastern Europe, and succeeded in pushing them out of Azerbaijan in northwestern Iran. It also helped the British to crush a communist regime in Greece. The United States tried its best to maintain Chiang Kai-shek's dictatorial rule in China, flying many of Chiang's troops northward to occupy Manchuria as the Russians pulled out after World War II. And it continues to prevent the Chinese from occupying their offshore islands, Quemoy and Matsu. After virtually installing the dictator Batista in Cuba, the United States tried desperately to oust the communist Castro regime by actions ranging from the CIA-engineered Bay of Pigs invasion to CIA mafia attempts to assassinate Castro. Of all America's recent wars, certainly the most traumatic for Americans and their attitude toward foreign policy was the Vietnam War. America's imperial war in Vietnam was indeed a microcosm of what has been tragically wrong with American foreign policy in this century. American intervention in Vietnam did not begin, as most people believe, with Kennedy or Eisenhower or even Truman. It began no later than the date when the American government, under Franklin Roosevelt, on November 26, 1941, delivered a sharp and insulting ultimatum to Japan to get its armed forces out of China and Indochina, from what would later be Vietnam. This U.S. ultimatum set the stage inevitably for Pearl Harbor. Engaged in a war in the Pacific to oust Japan from the Asian continent, the United States and its OSS, predecessor to the CIA, favored and aided Ho Chi Minh's communist-run national resistance movement against the Japanese. After World War II, the communist Viet Minh was in charge of all northern Vietnam. But then France, previously the imperial ruler of Vietnam, betrayed its agreement with Ho and massacred Viet Minh forces. In this double cross, France was aided by Britain and the United States. When the French lost to the reconstituted Viet Minh guerrilla movement under Ho, the United States endorsed the Geneva Agreement of 1954, under which Vietnam was to be quickly reunited as one nation. For it was generally recognized that the post-war occupation divisions of the country into North and South were purely arbitrary and merely for military convenience. But, having by trickery managed to oust the Viet Minh from the southern half of Vietnam, the United States proceeded to break the Geneva Agreement and to replace the French and their puppet emperor, Bao Dai, by its own clients, Ngo Dinh Diem and his family, who were installed in dictatorial rule over South Vietnam. When Diem became an embarrassment, the CIA engineered a coup to assassinate Diem and replace him with another dictatorial regime. To suppress the Viet Cong, the communist-led national independence movement in the South, the United States rained devastation on South and North Vietnam alike, bombing and murdering a million Vietnamese and dragging half a million American soldiers into the quagmires and jungles of Vietnam. Throughout the tragic Vietnamese conflict, the United States maintained the fiction that it was a war of aggression by the communist North Vietnamese state against a friendly and pro-Western, whatever that term may mean, South Vietnamese state, which had called for our aid. Actually, the war was really a doomed but lengthy attempt by an imperial United States to suppress the wishes of the great bulk of the Vietnamese population and to maintain unpopular client dictators in the southern half of the country by virtual genocide, if necessary. Americans are not accustomed to applying the term imperialism to the actions of the U.S. government, but the word is a particularly apt one. In its broadest sense, imperialism may be defined as aggression by State A against the people of Country B, followed by the subsequent coercive maintenance of such foreign rule. In our example above, the permanent rule by the Graustark state over formerly northeastern Belgravia would be an example of such imperialism. But imperialism does not have to take the form of direct rule over the foreign population. In the 20th century, the indirect form of neo-imperialism has increasingly replaced the old-fashioned direct kind. It is more subtle and less visible, but no less effective a form of imperialism. In this situation, the imperial state rules the foreign population through its effective control over native client rulers. This version of modern Western imperialism has been trenchantly defined by the libertarian historian Leonard Liggio. The imperialist power of the Western countries imposed on the world's peoples a double or reinforced system of exploitation, imperialism, by which the power of the Western governments maintains the local ruling class in exchange for the opportunity to superimpose Western exploitation upon existing exploitation by local states. This view of America as a long-time imperial world power has taken hold among historians in recent years as the result of compelling and scholarly work by a distinguished group of New Left revisionist historians inspired by Professor William Appleman Williams. But this was also the view of conservative as well as classical liberal isolationists during World War II and in the early days of the Cold War. Isolationist criticisms. The last anti-interventionist and anti-imperialist thrust of the old conservative and classical liberal isolationists came during the Korean War. Conservative George Morgenstern, chief editorial writer of the Chicago Tribune and author of the first revisionist book on Pearl Harbor, published an article in the right-wing Washington Weekly, Human Events, which detailed the grisly imperialist record of the United States government from the Spanish-American War down to Korea. Morgenstern noted that the exalted nonsense by which President McKinley had justified the war against Spain was familiar to anyone who later attended the evangelical rationalizations of Wilson for intervening in the European War, of Roosevelt promising the millennium, of Eisenhower treasuring the crusade in Europe that somehow went sour, or of Truman, Stevenson, Paul Douglas, or the New York Times preaching the Holy War in Korea. In a widely noted speech at the height of the American defeat in North Korea at the hands of the Chinese in late 1950, conservative isolationist Joseph P. Kennedy called for U.S. withdrawal from Korea. Kennedy proclaimed that, "I naturally opposed communism, but I said if portions of Europe or Asia wish to go communistic or even have communism thrust upon them, we cannot stop it." The result of the Cold War, the Truman Doctrine, and the Marshall Plan, Kennedy charged, was disaster, a failure to purchase friends and a threat of land war in Europe or Asia. Kennedy warned that half of this world will never submit to dictation by the other half. What business is it of ours to support French colonial policy in Indochina or to achieve Mr. Syngman Rhee's concepts of democracy in Korea? Shall we now send the Marines into the mountains of Tibet to keep the Dalai Lama on his throne? Economically, Kennedy added, we have been burdening ourselves with unnecessary debts as a consequence of Cold War policy. If we continue to weaken our economy with lavish spending either on foreign nations or in foreign wars, we run the danger of precipitating another 1932 and of destroying the very system which we are trying to save. Kennedy concluded that the only rational alternative for America is to scrap the Cold War foreign policy altogether, to get out of Korea and out of Berlin and Europe. The United States could not possibly contain Russian armies if they chose to march through Europe. And if Europe should then turn communist, communism may break of itself as a unified force. The more people that it will have to govern, the more necessary it becomes for those who govern to justify themselves to those being governed. The more peoples that are under its yoke, the greater are the possibilities of revolt. And here, at a time when cold warriors were forecasting a world communist monolith as an eternal fact of life, Joseph Kennedy cited Marshal Tito as pointing the way for the eventual breakup of the communist world. Thus, Mao in China is not likely to take his orders from Stalin. Kennedy realized that this policy will, of course, be criticized as appeasement. But is it appeasement to withdraw from unwise commitments? If it is wise, in our interest, not to make commitments that endanger our security, and this is appeasement, then I am for appeasement. Kennedy concluded that the suggestions I make would conserve American lives for American ends, not waste them in the freezing hills of Korea or on the battle-scarred plains of Western Germany. One of the most trenchant and forceful attacks on American foreign policy to emerge from the Korean War was leveled by the veteran classical liberal journalist Garrett Garrett. Garrett began his pamphlet, The Rise of Empire, 1952, by declaring, "We have crossed the boundary that lies between republic and empire." Explicitly linking this thesis with his notable pamphlet of the 1930s, The Revolution Was, which had denounced the advent of executive and statist tyranny within the republican form under the New Deal, Garrett once more saw a revolution within the form of the old constitutional republic. Garrett, for example, called Truman's intervention in Korea without a declaration of war a usurpation of congressional power. In his pamphlet, Garrett adumbrated the criteria, the hallmarks for the existence of empire. The first is the dominance of the executive power, a dominance reflected in the president's unauthorized intervention in Korea. The second is the subordination of domestic to foreign policy. The third, the ascendancy of the military mind. The fourth, a system of satellite nations. And the fifth, a complex of vaunting and fear. A vaunting of unlimited national might combined with a continuing fear of the enemy, of the barbarian, and of the unreliability of the satellite allies. Garrett found each one of these criteria to apply fully to the United States. Having discovered that the United States had developed all the hallmarks of empire, Garrett added that the United States, like previous empires, feels itself to be a prisoner of history. For beyond fear lies collective security, and the playing of the supposedly destined American role upon the world stage. Garrett concluded, "It is our turn." Our turn to do what? Our turn to assume the responsibilities of moral leadership in the world. Our turn to maintain a balance of power against the forces of evil everywhere, in Europe and Asia and Africa, in the Atlantic and in the Pacific, by air and by sea. Evil in this case being the Russian barbarian. Our turn to keep the peace of the world. Our turn to save civilization. Our turn to serve mankind. But this is the language of empire. The Roman Empire never doubted that it was the defender of civilization. Its good intentions were peace, law, and order. The Spanish Empire added salvation. The British Empire added the noble myth of the white man's burden. We have added freedom and democracy. Yet the more that may be added to it, the more it is the same language still, a language of power. War as the health of the state. Many libertarians are uncomfortable with foreign policy matters and prefer to spend their energies either on fundamental questions of libertarian theory or on such domestic concerns as the free market or privatizing postal service or garbage disposal. Yet an attack on war or a warlike foreign policy is of crucial importance to libertarians. There are two important reasons. One has become a cliché, but is all too true nevertheless: the overriding importance of preventing a nuclear holocaust. To all the long-standing reasons, moral and economic, against an interventionist foreign policy, has now been added the imminent, ever-present threat of world destruction. If the world should be destroyed, all the other problems and all the other isms, socialism, capitalism, liberalism, or libertarianism, would be of no importance whatsoever. Hence the prime importance of a peaceful foreign policy and of ending the nuclear threat. The other reason is that, apart from the nuclear menace, war, in the words of the libertarian Randolph Bourne, is the health of the state. War has always been the occasion of a great, and usually permanent, acceleration and intensification of state power over society. War is the great excuse for mobilizing all the energies and resources of the nation in the name of patriotic rhetoric under the aegis and dictation of the state apparatus. It is in war that the state really comes into its own, swelling in power, in number, in pride, in absolute dominion over the economy and the society. Society becomes a herd, seeking to kill its alleged enemies, rooting out and suppressing all dissent from the official war effort, happily betraying truth for the supposed public interest. Society becomes an armed camp, with the values and the morals, as the libertarian Albert J. Nock once phrased it, of an army on the march. It is particularly ironic that war always enables the state to rally the energies of its citizens under the slogan of helping it to defend the country against some bestial outside menace. For the root myth that enables the state to wax fat off war is the canard that war is a defense by the state of its subjects. The facts, however, are precisely the reverse. For if war is the health of the state, it is also its greatest danger. A state can only die by defeat in war or by revolution. In war, therefore, the state frantically mobilizes its subjects to fight for it against another state, under the pretext that it is fighting to defend them. In the history of the United States, war has generally been the main occasion for the often permanent intensification of the power of the state over society. In the War of 1812 against Great Britain, as we have indicated above, the modern inflationary fractional reserve banking system first came into being on a large scale, as did protective tariffs, internal federal taxation, and a standing army and navy. And a direct consequence of the wartime inflation was the reestablishment of a central bank, the Second Bank of the United States. Virtually all of these statist policies and institutions continued permanently after the war was over. The Civil War and its virtual one-party system led to the permanent establishment of a neo-mercantilist policy of big government and the subsidizing of various big business interests through protective tariffs, huge land grants, and other subsidies to railroads, federal excise taxation, and a federally controlled banking system. It also brought the first imposition of federal conscription and an income tax, setting dangerous precedents for the future. World War I brought the decisive and fateful turn from a relatively free and laissez-faire economy to the present system of corporate state monopoly at home and permanent global intervention abroad. The collectivist economic mobilization during the war, headed by War Industries Board Chairman Bernard Baruch, fulfilled the emerging dream of big business leaders and progressive intellectuals for a cartelized and monopolized economy planned by the federal government in cozy collaboration with big business leadership. And it was precisely this wartime collectivism that nurtured and developed a nationwide labor movement that would eagerly take its place as junior partner in the new corporate state economy. This temporary collectivism, furthermore, served as a permanent beacon and model for big business leaders and corporatist politicians as the kind of permanent peacetime economy that they would like to impose on the United States. As Food Czar, Secretary of Commerce, and later as President, Herbert C. Hoover helped bring this continuing monopolized statist economy into being. And the vision was fulfilled in a recrudescence of wartime agencies and even wartime personnel by Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. World War I also brought a permanent Wilsonian global intervention abroad, the fastening of the newly imposed Federal Reserve System, and a permanent income tax on society. High federal budgets, massive conscription, and intimate connections between economic boom, war contracts, and loans to Western nations. World War II was the culmination and fulfillment of all these trends. Franklin D. Roosevelt finally fastened upon American life the heady promise of the Wilsonian domestic and foreign program. Permanent partnership of big government, big business, and big unions. A continuing and ever-expanding military-industrial complex. Conscription. Continuing and accelerating inflation, and an endless and costly role as counter-revolutionary policeman for the entire world. The Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter world, and there is little substantive difference among any of these administrations, is corporate liberalism, the corporate state fulfilled. It is particularly ironic that conservatives, at least in rhetoric, supporters of a free market economy, should be so complacent and even admiring of our vast military-industrial complex. There is no greater single distortion of the free market in present-day America. The bulk of our scientists and engineers has been diverted from basic research for civilian ends, from increasing productivity and the standard of living of consumers, into wasteful, inefficient, and non-productive military and space boondoggles. These boondoggles are every bit as wasteful, but infinitely more destructive, than the vast pyramid building of the pharaoh. It is no accident that Lord Keynes' economics have proved to be the economics par excellence of the corporate liberal state. For Keynesian economists place equal approval upon all forms of government spending, whether on pyramids, missiles, or steel plants. By definition, all of these expenditures swell the gross national product, regardless of how wasteful they may be. It is only recently that many liberals have begun to awaken to the evils of the waste, inflation, and militarism that Keynesian corporate liberalism has brought to America. As the scope of government spending, military and civilian alike, has widened, science and industry have been skewed more and more into unproductive goals and highly inefficient processes. The goal of satisfying consumers as efficiently as possible has been increasingly replaced by the currying of favors by government contractors, often in the form of highly wasteful cost-plus contracts. Politics, in field after field, has replaced economics in guiding the activities of industry. Furthermore, as entire industries and regions of the country have come to depend upon government and military contracts, a huge vested interest has been created in continuing the programs, heedless of whether they retain even the most threadbare excuse of military necessity. Our economic prosperity has been made to depend on continuing the narcotic of unproductive and anti-productive government spending. One of the most perceptive and prophetic critics of America's entry into World War II was the classical liberal writer John T. Flynn. In his As We Go Marching, written in the midst of the war he had tried so hard to forestall, Flynn charged that the New Deal, culminating in its wartime embodiment, had finally established the corporate state that important elements of big business had been seeking since the turn of the 20th century. The general idea, Flynn wrote, was to reorder the society by making it a planned and coerced economy instead of a free one, in which business would be brought together into great guilds or an immense corporative structure, combining the elements of self-rule and government supervision with a national economic policing system to enforce these decrees. This, after all, is not so very far from what business had been talking about. The New Deal had first attempted to create such a new society in the National Recovery Administration and the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, mighty engines of regimentation hailed by labor and business alike. Now the advent of World War II had reestablished this collectivist program, an economy supported by great streams of debt under complete control, with nearly all the planning agencies functioning with almost totalitarian power under a vast bureaucracy. After the war, Flynn prophesied, the New Deal would attempt to expand this system permanently into international affairs. He wisely predicted that the great emphasis of vast governmental spending after the war would continue to be military, since this is the one form of government spending to which conservatives would never object, and which workers would also welcome for its creation of jobs. Thus, militarism is the one great glamorous public works project upon which a variety of elements in the community can be brought into agreement. Flynn predicted that America's post-war policy would be internationalist in the sense of being imperialist. Imperialism is, of course, international in the sense that war is international, and it will follow from the policy of militarism. We will do what other countries have done. We will keep alive the fears of our people of the aggressive ambitions of other countries, and we will ourselves embark upon imperialistic enterprises of our own. Imperialism will ensure for the United States the existence of perpetual enemies, of waging what Charles A. Beard was later to call perpetual war for perpetual peace. For, Flynn pointed out, we have managed to acquire bases all over the world. There is no part of the world where trouble can break out where we cannot claim that our interests are menaced. Thus menaced, there must remain, when the war is over, a continuing argument in the hands of the imperialists for a vast naval establishment and a huge army, ready to attack anywhere or to resist an attack from all the enemies we shall be obliged to have. One of the most moving portrayals of the change in American life wrought by World War II was written by John Dos Passos, a lifelong radical and individualist who was pushed from extreme left to extreme right by the march of the New Deal. Dos Passos expressed his bitterness in his post-war novel, The Grand Design. At home, we organized blood banks and civilian defense and imitated the rest of the world by setting up concentration camps, only we called them relocation centers, and stuffing into them American citizens of Japanese ancestry without benefit of habeas corpus. The President of the United States talked the sincere Democrat, and so did the members of Congress. In the administration, there were devout believers in civil liberty. Now we're busy fighting a war. We'll deploy all four freedoms later on, they said. War is a time of Caesars. And the American people were supposed to say, thank you for the century of the common man turned over for relocation behind barbed wire, so help him God. We learned. There are things we learned to do. But we have not learned, in spite of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the great debates at Richmond and Philadelphia, how to put power over the lives of men into the hands of one man and to make him use it wisely. Soviet Foreign Policy. In a previous chapter, we have already dealt with the problem of national defense, abstracting from the question of whether the Russians are really hell-bent upon a military attack upon the United States. Since World War II, American military and foreign policy, at least rhetorically, has been based upon the assumption of a looming threat of Russian attack, an assumption that has managed to gain public approval for global American intervention and for scores of billions in military expenditures. But how realistic, how well-grounded, is this assumption? First, there is no doubt that the Soviets, along with all other Marxist-Leninists, would like to replace all existing social systems by communist regimes. But such a sentiment, of course, scarcely implies any sort of realistic threat of attack, just as an ill wish in private life can hardly be grounds for realistic expectation of imminent aggression. On the contrary, Marxism-Leninism itself believes that a victory of communism is inevitable, not on the wings of outside force, but rather from accumulating tensions and contradictions within each society. So Marxism-Leninism considers internal revolution, or in the current Euro-communist version, democratic change, for installing communism to be inevitable. At the same time, it holds any coercive external imposition of communism to be at best suspect, and at worst disruptive and counterproductive of genuine organic social change. Any idea of exporting communism to other countries on the backs of the Soviet military is totally contradictory to Marxist-Leninist theory. We are not saying, of course, that Soviet leaders will never do anything contrary to Marxist-Leninist theory. But to the extent that they act as ordinary rulers of a strong Russian nation-state, the case for an imminent Soviet threat to the United States is gravely weakened. For the sole alleged basis of such a threat, as conjured up by our Cold Warriors, is the Soviet Union's alleged devotion to Marxist-Leninist theory and to its ultimate goal of world communist triumph. If the Soviet rulers were simply to act as Russian dictators, consulting only their own nation-state interests, then the entire basis for treating the Soviets as a uniquely diabolic source of imminent military assault crumbles to the ground. When the Bolsheviks took power in Russia in 1917, they had given little thought to a future Soviet foreign policy, for they were convinced that communist revolution would soon follow in the advanced industrial countries of Western Europe.
All right, y'all. I'm Scott. This is Sunk Cost Fallacy Radio. I've been on hold with these bastards at Blue Cross all day. May they all burn. But I gotta get through and get this thing resolved with these people. So I'm playing this, and you know, I'm sure this might sound at first glance. Can you glance with your ears? It sounds like maybe who cares about Jeff Rickenbach reading Murray Rothbard about the Soviet Union, about current day policy back in the late 1970s. But for me, this is incredibly interesting. It's some of Murray Rothbard's best revisionism of the Cold War, and it's a sample taken from the late 70s, so it's a great little snapshot, and it certainly helped to inform my perspective on the Cold War as it was taught to me and as I know it now. So here's some more of that, and later on, I swear I'm going to complain about things. I know y'all love to hear me complain, and also I'm going to interview Robert Nayman from Just Foreign Policy, so stick around.
Such hopes were dashed after the end of World War I. Lenin and his fellow Bolsheviks adopted the theory of peaceful coexistence as the basic foreign policy for a communist state. The idea was this. As the first successful communist movement, Soviet Russia would serve as a beacon for and supporter of other communist parties throughout the world. But the Soviet state qua state would devote itself to peaceful relations with all other countries and would not attempt to export communism through interstate warfare. The idea here was not just to follow Marxist-Leninist theory, but was the highly practical course of holding the survival of the existing communist state as the foremost goal of foreign policy. That is, never to endanger the Soviet state by courting interstate warfare. Other countries would be expected to become communist by their own internal processes. Thus, fortuitously, from a mixture of theoretical and practical grounds of their own, the Soviets arrived early at what libertarians consider to be the only proper and principled foreign policy. As time went on, furthermore, this policy was reinforced by a conservatism that comes upon all movements after they have acquired and retained power for any length of time, in which the interests of keeping power over one's nation-state begins to take more and more precedence over the initial idea of world revolution. This increasing conservatism under Stalin and his successors strengthened and reinforced the non-aggressive, peaceful coexistence policy. The Bolsheviks indeed began their success story by being literally the only political party in Russia to clamor from the beginning of World War I for an immediate Russian pullout from the war. Indeed, they went further and courted enormous unpopularity among the public by calling for the defeat of their own government, revolutionary defeatism. When Russia began to suffer enormous losses, accompanied by massive military desertions from the front, and the war became extremely unpopular, the Bolsheviks, guided by Lenin, continued to be the only party to call for an immediate end to the war, the other parties still vowing to fight the Germans to the end. When the Bolsheviks took power, Lenin, over the hysterical opposition of even the majority of the Bolshevik Central Committee itself, insisted on concluding the appeasement peace of Brest-Litovsk in March 1918. Here, Lenin succeeded in taking Russia out of the war, even at the price of granting to the victorious German army all the parts of the Russian Empire which it then occupied, including White Russia and the Ukraine. Thus, Lenin and the Bolsheviks began their reign by being not simply a peace party, but virtually a peace-at-any-price party. After World War I and Germany's defeat, the new Polish state attacked Russia and succeeded in grabbing for itself a large chunk of White Russia and the Ukraine. Taking advantage of the turmoil and of the civil war within Russia at the end of the war, various other national groups, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, decided to break away from the pre-World War I Russian Empire and declare national independence. Now, while Leninism pays lip service to national self-determination, to Soviet rulers from the very beginning, it was clear that the boundaries of the old Russian state were supposed to remain intact. The Red Army reconquered the Ukraine, not only from the whites, but also from the Ukrainian nationalists and from the indigenously Ukrainian anarchist army of Nestor Makhno as well. For the rest, it was clear that Russia, like Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, was a revisionist country vis-à-vis the post-war settlement at Versailles. That is, the lodestar of both Russian and German foreign policy was to recapture their pre-World War I borders, what they both considered the true borders of their respective states. It should be noted that every political party or tendency in Russia and Germany, whether ruling the state or in opposition, agreed with this aim of full restoration of national territory. But it should be emphasized, while Germany under Hitler took strong measures to recapture the lost lands, the cautious and conservative Soviet rulers did absolutely nothing. Only after the Stalin-Hitler Pact and the German conquest of Poland did the Soviets, now facing no danger in doing so, recapture their lost territories. Specifically, the Russians repossessed Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, as well as the old Russian lands of White Russia and the Ukraine that had been eastern Poland. And they were able to do so without a fight. The old pre-World War I Russia had now been restored, with the exception of Finland. But Finland was prepared to fight. Here, the Russians demanded not the reincorporation of Finland as a whole, but only of parts of the Karelian Isthmus, which were ethnically Russian. When the Finns refused this demand, the Winter War, 1939-1940, between Russia and Finland ensued, which ended with the Finns conceding only Russian Karelia. On June 22, 1941, Germany, triumphant over everyone but England in the West, launched a sudden, massive, and unprovoked assault on Soviet Russia. Aggression aided and abetted by the other pro-German states in Eastern Europe. Hungary,
no
Romania,
healthcare for
Bulgaria,
me.
Slovakia,
I don't really need anybody. You know, I got a wife who needs some, but man, I wish I had the dark side of the force. That would solve all of my problems, you know? Then I would just, I would cause horrible things to happen to people. You guys would think, some libertarian that guy turned out to be. Yeah, once we gave him total power, he unleashed it. And all the people at the call center, oh, they paid the price. The call center people, the worst people in the world. How can he leave somebody on hold and then just straight hang up on them without even saying laters or nothing, you know? It ain't right. It ain't right. I wonder which other health insurance companies Texas law allows me to do business with. It's not a question of the market, right? It's only a question of conspiracies between Republicans and Democrats. So maybe I'll just have to switch to whatever. Not Medicaid. I don't care how poor I am. I'm never going on that. Let's go ahead and drown me in the river, man. I would prefer a market to a fascist state, but you know, the insurance companies, man, that's the most rigged game of them all. You want to know why you live in a totalitarian state? Because those companies insist that it goes this way. It's just price fixing. They got all kinds of fancy names for it. I call it price fixing. Horrible. All right, well, so Robert Naiman's coming up on the show. He's going to say smart stuff about the war in Afghanistan that I think you'll like. I'll do my best to ask him questions. How did you guys like that Rickenbach reading Rothbard? I really like Jeff Rickenbach. I really like Murray Rothbard. That was chapter 14, War and Foreign Policy, from the book For a New Liberty, The Libertarian Manifesto, which you can find in its entirety in audiobook and every other format under the sun at Mises.org. Really good stuff. Lots of good Russian history. Lots of good all kinds of history. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, good old Murray Rothbard, man. He wrote lots of good stuff. So anyway, I don't know. I was on hold for a long, long time. I finally gave up. Sorry for ruining the show for you, everybody. Here's some show. They passed a $630 billion Pentagon budget. That's a lot. I would recommend to you also, along the lines of that Rothbard piece, if you're interested, there's a new one at FFF.org by Jacob Hornberger. In fact, I think it's on antiwar.com today. Yeah, it is. The Sordid Roots of the National Security State. And it's about the big, fake, corrupt Cold War, the one that Murray Rothbard was just describing to you, too. And Jacob Hornberger's got a great piece about that. And, you know, I grew up under the Cold War, and it seemed very real to me. But it just turned out, like Murray Rothbard was making the case there, that the Soviets were never an offensive military threat to the U.S. And further, the U.S. government knew that. As Chalmers Johnson concluded after the Cold War, wow, I was a damned fool. Oops. Spear carrier for empire. Fell for a lie, obviously, because if the whole world empire was just to contain the Soviet Union, the red menace that needed containing so bad, then how come the empire didn't go away when the Soviet one did? And the answer was, because the Soviet Union was just an excuse for an offensive empire. They weren't trying to contain us. They were just trying to withstand us. But it was, you know, us defined very broadly, of course. Forgive my loose use of the English language, but these things happen. But anyway, So Jacob Hornberger's got a great one like that, The Sordid Roots of the National Security State. And I want to play this short clip. It's just a minute and a half long or something now. Sorry, more recorded audio for you. This is Ike Eisenhower, who is the supreme allied commander of the U.S.-British invasion of Europe to liberate France and the Western democracies from the occupation of the vile Nazi Germans. And therefore, he could have picked which party he wanted to be the nominee of, basically. Decided to be a Republican and was the president and has a whole era named after him and everything there. We talked with Mike Swanson on the show about his various battles with the military state and its interest in always trying to find excuses to grow and how hard it was for even him to face them down and cut their budgets in any meaningful way when he was the one most qualified to do it because he understood the military the best because he was him. Ike Eisenhower. And of course, he's very famous for the military-industrial complex speech, which he gave on the last day in office, when he said, "Man, the thing that I have allowed to be built up over the last 8 years, good luck containing that, everybody. This thing that I barely define and you don't understand." But anyway, have a nice life. I think that was basically his argument. Well, here's a speech from April 16th, 1953. And this is where he draws the contrast about military spending. Keep in mind, it's $630 billion military budget for this year. And he compares that to what this money could be spent on instead. And never mind what you learned in government school about how when government creates money and spends it on weapons of death and destruction, that that's somehow a giant boost to the gross domestic product. Ike Eisenhower knows better than that. He explains in this speech how that's not the case. But here it is from him, and then we're going to get back, talk a little bit more about this money. And then Robert Neyman coming up, too. So here.
...begins very quickly every to take on the attributes made of a ruling class
See,
with
I'm
a class
so
interest in retaining
hosting
state.
Radio. What the hell am I doing? Still have Rothbard playing. Here.
...ship launched. Every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
All right, so there you go. The lost opportunity cost. You can't even imagine where that wealth could have gone instead. Nobody even knows. One of my tabs open today is about how the IED changed the American way of war at stripes.com. And, you know, the stars and stripes. And in the comments, these are all very, you know, military culture people hanging out there in the comments section, talking with each other and saying, God, all these young lives, all these talents just wasted. These guys, their bodies literally torn apart, their lives torn apart, if they survive, you know? And then, geez, what they could have done instead with their hopes and their dreams and the wealth that went into transporting them over there and arming them and sending them out there to get blown up in the first place. Yep, that's about the sum of it. And for what now? We talked about the other day. I'll talk with Robert Naiman in a minute about how the polls say, yep, never should have fought the Afghan war in the first place. Boy, was that so hard? We couldn't have done that 10 years ago? Man. On one hand, I'm kind of mad that all of a sudden everybody's attitude is just like, yeah, I guess, yeah, never mind that whole thing. Man, is it really that easy? Because I was always trying to make the case it was that easy, but nobody ever agreed with me. Can't leave now. All those people would have died in vain. Gotta stay forever until whenever comes. But, you know, it's Reagan's budget secretary, right, David Stockman, who's all over TV, and he's got this massive tome. I haven't even gotten to it yet. It's called The Great Deformation. And I've read reviews of the book anyway, and, you know, he's a Goyetian on the gigantic bubble that all these financial bubbles are riding on the back of, the giant post-Nixon paper money bubble, and all the government spending and all the distortions. But a huge part of his argument is the empire. And he's a Republican type. And never even mind, just put aside for the moment, because I don't know that much about this part of the book, because I haven't read it yet. But from what I read reviews about the imperial part, where he just talks about, you know, the deformation, that's the best word for it, right? The great distortion in the economy. Nobody knows exactly what would be instead, but it'd be a hell of a lot better than this. And there are, man, I'm not a master of these statistics. I should be better at them. But the number of people who are going hungry right now, the number of people who are underemployed, if they've got work at all, the number of people who are outright unemployed, number of people got jobs and still don't have a place to stay in America right now is in the bazillions and millions and millions and tens of millions and who knows. What the hell? And it's because, basically, well, it's like the poll numbers say the other day, people are finally catching on that the enemy is the government itself. They're the enemy of the country. They're at war with us. And, you know, on behalf of those who have the access to buy them the Coke and the whores and the steak dinners that they need to appropriate the money and bend the rules for the people who got the access. The richer you are, the easier it is to keep winning once you buy up some congressmen. House of Representatives, they're a dime a dozen. Senators, two bits. Get whatever you want. Oh, and of course, in the military, as William S. Lind said, the conservative military strategist, the Pentagon budget is the biggest honeypot in the history of the world. There's never been anything like it before. It's just, it is the grandest theft that has ever happened. I guess, I mean, he said that back before the crash and the bailouts of 08. But he was considering previous bailouts, and there have been some big ones before. But he was saying, this is the biggest ripoff ever, ever. And, you know, looking from the dawn of the terror war, September 11th on, you're talking between now $8, $10, $11 trillion, something like that. It was, what, eight and change when we talked with Chris Hellman at the National Priorities Project probably a year and a half ago last time, you know? That was his, and all the Homeland Security state, the cost of all the wars, and the cost of all the veterans care, and all the interest on the debt. It's bad medicine. And you know, I'm not sure exactly what would happen if I had magical powers and I could make the U.S. state and all of its interventions in every aspect of our lives just completely evaporate. All those people thrown out of work. And yet, all those people set free at the same time to do what they want. all those people let out of prison, literally set free to do what they want. It seems to me like maybe it would be a pretty hard shock, but for just a little while. It couldn't possibly be as bad as continuing on like this. And I guess this is where I do my little thing about the Jekyll Island rant. It's 100 years. 2013, it's 100 years since the Congress and the President conspired to create the latest version of America's central bank, the Federal Reserve System. And it is sort of kind of private, and in all the worst ways that you imagine, in the corruption of having certain private interests completely embedded in the thing. But it is a government agency with government police power, and they set the interest rate at which banks loan money to each other, which is a lot of influence. And of course, they can just create bonds and buy them, basically. They got the ultimate bookkeeping trick. They can create money. And then they set the rules for all the private banks that have to be members of the system itself for how much money that they can create out of nothing. So it's the ultimate fascist cartel where the banks promise to keep buying government debt and the government promises to keep letting the banks create money that they want to loan to people and collect interest on thin air. And so it's a giant scam. It's probably a bigger scam even than the Pentagon, because where do you think the Pentagon gets all their money from? But, of course, the root of it all is the Congress that James Madison created. That's the real problem. But the Federal Reserve, not just do they inflate and that's stealing, because that's pretty bad. That's really bad. And it causes a lot of problems. But what causes the real problems is the business cycle, the boom and the bust. You know, the Chicago School Reaganite pretend capitalists, the conservatives, the fascists, they say, well, we ought to have inflation all the time of about 3%. And the Federal Reserve should just target that. And then that'll be great. And it'll account for growth. And we won't have too much distortion and this and that. There's no such thing as that. They can't create 3% inflation across the board. What they do is they create giant bubbles in bank stocks, giant bubbles on Wall Street, giant bubbles in housing, giant bubbles in chosen tech companies, in college educations, and the bonds backing up those. Boy, there's one that's coming due. And anyway, so what happens is, On the back of that gigantic, the great deformation, are all these smaller bubbles. And they're not that small if you ask the people who are just, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, which is most people. These severe dislocations created at the billionaire level by the zillionaires are enough to, throw people's lives completely into turmoil. I've told you this one a million times, and I'll keep telling it to you over and over again because it seems relevant and important to me, that at the Federal Reserve, according to William Grierder from the Washington Post and the Nation and the very official kind of revisionist sort of kind of history, sort of kind of revisionist history of the Volcker years in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s at the Federal Reserve, he talks in there about how they keep all the statistics on suicides, on broken businesses and broken marriages and broken families and kids in foster care and all of the consequences as much as they can get. They, you know, they're like, they got computers for brains. They don't know what data is relevant or not. They don't know what to look at or not. So they're sucking it all up like the NSA and trying to figure out what the hell they're doing, because they don't know what the hell they're doing. But one of the things in there is that, of course, the nice people want to keep inflating, and it's the stodgy old meanies who want to try to beat inflation by cranking up the interest rates. But the truth is, as long as you have a central bank and you have Volcker deliberately causing the recession that they've been inflating to prevent all that time, that did cause a lot of horrible pain for people. That did cause a suicide rate to go up, and it would have alleviated that. You know, this is the problem that you get into when you're central planning, because it was for the greater good. that they beat inflation at the time, but they're hurting a lot of individuals that way, which you can't really put it that way when you're talking about the market setting the rate of interest. But that is what it is when it's the central bank. And anyway, they screw us coming and going, and they keep track of the pain that they cause, and it's all just with the question, basically, how much we'll let them get away with. And mostly, it's endless, because mostly people don't get it. And I don't know why it's so hard to understand. It's just like that movie Titanic that y'all like so much, where the real rich people, they're all in on it against all the people locked in the lower thing. Did you ever see that movie? Oh, all you people locked down in there? Yeah, stay down in there. We're going to get on boats and leave you behind. That's the government and the businessmen. Get it? And the big, giant Titanic is your world empire, and it's going down. Ain't that brilliant? Oh, man, I got to go. Coming up next, Robert Naiman. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for your patience. At least I got good bumper music. All right. Robert Naiman is on the line. He's from Just Foreign Policy at justforeignpolicy.org. And he also writes for truthout.org as well. How's it going, Robert?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. And I'm hoping I got my telephone technical problem solved. I think I did. You sound good. You're in Athens, huh? Birthplace of Western democracy and all that. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So are there temples all around you and all that cool stuff like on TV?
No, actually there are cars all around me.
Oh, well, that's not quite the same.
That's the kind of temple.
Acropolis from there, whatever, right?
Yeah, no, the Acropolis is here, right by downtown Athens. It's very beautiful.
Oh, that's cool. All right, well, I'm going to get an airplane one day. Hey, listen, so thanks for writing great stuff all the time. I really like this thing that you put together about President Karzai stand tall against U.S. pressure to sign the troop deal. What kind of treacherous treason do you mean by that there, Robert?
Well, you know, it was the reporting in the New York Times that just drove me mad. Because they reported what's going on upside down from the point of view of the way that most Americans would see it. From the point of view of this New York Times reporting, it's a big, terrible tragedy that President Karzai is refusing to sign the deal that would allow thousands of U.S. troops to remain in Afghanistan after 2014. And this is the opposite of the way most Americans do, because most Americans don't want U.S. troops to stay in Afghanistan. So, like, the big disaster that the New York Times reporter is afraid of is that the you know, the deal might break down, Karzai might refuse to sign, they might not be able to agree, and then all U.S. troops would have to withdraw from Afghanistan. Oh, my God, how terrible would that be? But it's even worse than that. The thing that the New York Times is hiding is that Karzai hasn't even said, you know, like, no, I don't want a deal. He said, I have conditions. What are the two conditions? The two conditions are that the U.S. transfer Afghan prisoners from Guantanamo to Afghanistan. That's condition number one. Condition number two is that the U.S. start peace talks with the Afghan Taliban to end the war. Now, what's striking about these two conditions is that they're both stated U.S. policy. First of all, it's stated U.S. policy to try and close Guantanamo. Secondly, the Obama administration itself tried to transfer Afghan Taliban prisoners from Guantanamo to Qatar as part of trying to start the peace talks with the Taliban, as well as free Bo Bergdahl, the U.S. soldier who's in Taliban captivity in a prisoner swap. And it's U.S. policy to start peace talks with the Afghan Taliban. So everything that Karzai is demanding are things that the U.S. government says it wants to do, but hasn't done because it hasn't had the political will yet to follow through with its own policies in the face of some Republican opposition in Congress. And if the U.S. did these things, release the Afghan prisoners or transfer them to Afghanistan, started the peace talks, ideally that would lead to ending the war, which means that either way, it's win-win from the point of view of the interest of the majority of Americans. Either the deal breaks down, in which case the U.S. troops come home, or Karzai gets what he wants, in which case the peace process starts and the war starts to wind down. The war ends, the U.S. troops come home. And meanwhile, if there's a political deal, the U.S. troops are much less likely to get blown up as long as they stay. So either way, Karzai stand is in the interest of U.S. troops not getting blown up, U.S. troops coming home. Therefore, the interests of the majority of Americans are 180 degrees from the way the New York Times is reporting the story. The interests of the majority of Americans are for Karzai to stand tall.
Well, it seems to me, well, let me ask you, so what's the Obama administration's policy? Nothing? I mean, they're going to get one or the other of those answers anyway. What are they doing? What do they think they're doing?
Well, as always, you know, the U.S. government is a big place. What Obama says and what he does are not always exactly the same thing. And even, you know, when the U.S. government policy is moving in a certain direction, that doesn't tell you whether it's going to get there next week or next year. So, yes, it's the policy of the U.S. to try to have peace talks and get a political deal. But the question is, how hard are they going to try to do that? What Karzai is doing is putting pressure on them to make it more of a priority. Now, something just happened in Congress which should make it easier. The National Defense Authorization Act just passed Congress. It has provisions to loosen the congressional restraints on President Obama's transfer of detainees from Guantanamo. So some people are saying, okay, now the ball is really in Obama's court. He could transfer these guys. He could get the whole ball rolling. Transfer the Afghan prisoners, bring home Bo Bergdahl, get the peace talks started, and therefore get the agreement signed. We could see that in the next couple months. It's more likely that we would see it if there starts to be some public pressure and congressional pressure from the other side. You know, there's a million cards campaign now. People are sending Christmas cards for Bo Bergdahl to the White House to dramatize the fact that, you know, we're still pushing to bring our guy home. This kind of pressure could help move the Obama administration to get off its butt and get this process moving.
Yeah. Did you see the thing where Dana Rohrabacher asked the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Afghan War at the Pentagon and his counterparts about how many American casualties we've had in the last year and how much money is spent, and they had no idea? They had to settle for get back.
Yeah, Yeah, they're not focused on these numbers, and they're not in control of these numbers. And there's a tendency to just, you know, keep doing what they're doing and not be willing to, you know, take decisive steps to make something else happen. You know, Richard Holbrooke, the UN special ambassador for Afghanistan and Pakistan, he was asked, how will you know, when it's good enough? What's the goal? And he said, we'll know it when we see it. So, you know, that's your answer. Like, what's the goal? Well, you know, we'll tell you when we've reached it. We'll tell you what the goal was. That's their ideal world, where they're not accountable for telling you what the goal was and then meeting the goal. I think the main thing that, you know, they want to be able to bring out most of the troops and say they had some kind of success and have the thing not blow up. But in order for that to happen, there has to be a political process. In order for there to be a political process, they got to put some skin in the game. They got to make things happen, like making the Afghan Taliban prisoners go home. That's an objective, concrete thing. Everybody could see. When that happens, everybody's going to say, okay, wow, now the Obama administration's really doing something.
Right. Well, and meanwhile, Taliban just walked right in and took over some large part of Kandahar, and the government forces just walked away.
Well, that's a foregone conclusion. There is no question that as U.S. forces leave, large parts of Afghanistan will be taken over by the Afghan Taliban. That is a given. That's another reason why there should be a political process. As U.S. forces leave, Afghan Taliban are going to come back. Do you want that to happen in a chaotic, messy way, or do you want to have that happen in an agreed way where, you know, you have some control over how this is happening, and it's not like, you know, U.S. forces lifting off of the Vietnamese embassy in Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, exactly. Nobody wants that, right? It seems like they're sort of sleepwalking towards that if they don't get out in a deliberate fashion. But so it sounds like to me what you're saying, Robert, is that there's really no chance that they're staying till 2024. That if there's no deal for immunity, then they have to go. And if they're going to have a deal, it's going to have to be, well, I don't know, that would be two different deals, right? One with the government of the so-called government of Hamid Karzai, and then another with the Taliban, and see if they're going to let Karzai live while we leave, kind of a thing. But you're saying if they have any deal with the Taliban, that's going to necessarily include the withdrawal of all forces.
Well, look, we don't know at the end of the day what's possible. Nobody can predict. But I think there's good reason to believe
I lose you. Good reason to believe. Yeah, that's good enough for me. Robert, are you there? Light's still green. Dope. Well, let's see. Let's try one more time. Don't worry about it. It's live radio. These things happen. He's on the phone in Athens, for crying out loud. He was driving around in traffic. It's not always easy being a cell phone in Athens. I mean, why not? I don't know. Apparently it's not. Oh, man. Someone's talking to me in Greek. Oh, well. I'll give it one more try. Hey, it's ringing, so that's good. Less dead air, more ringing. At least. Bo Bergdahl, gotta get back to that question in a second, if we can.
This is Robert Neiman, just for a policy.
Alright, well, anyway, so. That was Robert Naiman. Reason to believe. I could have ended on a worse note. Isn't that funny to have a war where no one in Washington, D.C. even knows or cares about it at all anymore? Isn't that something? They won't negotiate with their sock puppet dictator. They won't negotiate with their enemies. They're drawing down, so it's a question of force protection, really, like he was saying. Are they going to have like a fall of Saigon thing here with the Taliban, who are already kind of sort of part of the government anyway? Just come waltzing right into Kabul, and our guys got to flee on helicopters? Just robots flying around in circles to hold off the hordes. You know, there have been wars in Afghanistan that ended that way. There's a famous painting of the last British soldier. They let one wounded soldier leave and cross the Khyber Pass into Pakistan. And just so he could tell the tale. About how, don't try to conquer those guys. They're not very easy to conquer. Anyway. So, one thing I was going to ask him, if I had the time, was going to be about the nuke deal and the sanctions in the U.S. Senate. I think Naiman's the type who would have said, make the phone call, you know? Call your congressman, especially, you know, if they're conservatives, but you think they're, you know, possible to reach at all on this. Tell them I'm against Obama on everything except this. This is really important. Hey, that might be Robert Naiman calling back.
Hello?
Man, that was Robert Naiman's hotel calling me. That's a problem. Poor guy. He's not going to get a hold of his hotel guy. His hotel guy's calling my house. Oh, well, I don't know. Is something wrong with this microphone? It seems like my lows are really low. But why should they be? You know, I ought to be able to mumble, and you ought to be able to hear me just fine when I'm mumbling. What's going on with this thing? I can mumble if I want. All right, so yeah, the nuke deal. Those, as Jim Loeb wrote, I was talking to you about this yesterday, as Jim Loeb wrote, those who are financed by AIPAC the most in the U.S. Senate are leading the charge for new sanctions to destroy the Iran nuclear deal. Right when Obama needs them to not do that, because that's part of the preliminary deal, is no new sanctions. And they're trying to ruin that because they want a war on behalf of a foreign power. It's Menendez and Kirk and Schumer and who's the other? I forget. Anyway, and I quoted in that Jim Loeb article yesterday about them bragging, about the neoconservatives bragging that never even mind, you know, Schumer and Menendez leading the charge against this. Think about the silence of all the rest of them. Hey, if you want power in Washington, D.C., you cannot cross the Israel lobby. Simple as that. So any senator who comes out hard charging against this, especially if it's looking more and more like Israel's fifth column will be able to successfully undermine it, who tries to come out on the side of their own party's president on this, they'll have no future. It'll be, you know, carved in stone. You crossed AIPAC, that's it. No more money for you. Yes, more money for anyone who opposes you. Simple as that. And that's how it is. And so Chuck Schumer and Menendez and Mark Kurt, these guys are agents of a foreign power. Just straight bought off. It's right there in the record how much money they get. And like I said, it's measly hundreds of thousands. You know, just enough for some TV ads or whatever. 30 pieces of silver. It's nothing. It's just the slightest treachery. They don't care. And you know what bothers me about this is it seems like, what about Houston? Don't these guys have any courage whatsoever to tell the government what to do? I thought that the oil companies ran everything. Whatever happened to that? I know, Greg Palast would say they want to redline all that oil and keep it off the market and keep the price artificially high. But you know what? I think they can make money selling Iranian oil and get plenty of kickbacks too, and everybody be happy. What about that? That's what Dick Cheney used to say back in 1998. He committed the ultimate sin of going overseas to criticize his own government. That's a horrible sin, according to a conservative. But anyway, he was in Australia, and he correctly said, hey, what is it with this Bill Clinton guy? He's trying to keep my great company Halliburton from doing deals with the Iranians. These sanctions are wrong. They should be lifted. The Iranians are people, too. We can do business with them. And through business lies peace and mutual understanding. Oh, man. Okay, it wasn't that good, but it was pretty good. And, you know, don't give him a Marine Corps of his own because he'll come up with different plans. Don't give him a Treasury Department of his own. He'll use it. But give him a Halliburton to run, and all of a sudden he's Mr. Free Trade. But anyway, and then here's another thing I got to say about that. These Democrats, and I mean the Obama bots. I don't mean the Obama bots. I mean the government, the administration, the White House. They keep saying, listen, if you guys ruin this deal, that's the path to war. Well, okay. I appreciate you're trying to get this thing done. I want the deal done myself. However, it's not the path to war if it doesn't fall apart. What they should be saying is, if this falls apart, it's the path to even more talks. Because this is a fake threat anyway. They're not making nukes, and even if they were, it still wouldn't be a threat. How do you like that? What's so hard about that to say? Democrats. They remind me of Rand Paul, you know? Concede every false premise of your opponents, but then still try to stick with your position that makes no sense now. What is it with that? By the way, it says here, Pierre Omidyar provides the initial funding of $50 million to establish First Look Media. There you go. It's on Glenn Greenwald. I don't know exactly what his title is, but he's running this thing. I hope it'll be great. I hope he's got great plans. I can imagine that he's been imagining quite a bit. I hope he gets it. Yeah, jihadists rule the entire insurgency in Syria, which has pretty much been the case all along. FSA was never really a force, but now they're nothing. Now they're not even not really a force. And the Al-Qaeda guys are being accused of torture of children. And the U.S. is still putting out conflicting reports about whether they want to get closer to the Al-Qaedaites or whether they want to go ahead and switch back to Bashar al-Assad and the Ba'athists. Really. Take your pick. Maybe a little bit of both. And you know what? Maybe this has helped to weaken Iran somewhat, but really? I mean, Assad is going to survive. Maybe his control of the whole country will be, you know, greatly weakened. But it doesn't look like he's leaving power in Damascus. Not anytime soon. And there are all these, you know, purported plans of Prince Bandar to double down and send all this money and weapons, but I don't think it's going to make the difference. The Baathists are still backed by the Russians, for crying out loud. So it ain't like they're helpless, you know? But anyway, I read an interview with Flint Leverett about the situation in Syria there at Race for Iran. Somebody interviewing him in print. And he was talking about how the policy makes no sense because it's based on illusions. And it's, you know, in a way it's hard for me to accept, but I think more and more that this is really the case. That the people who are in charge of all these policies are basically, you know, like Hillary Clinton. She could be the hectoring head of your local PTA. Doesn't mean that she's got any special skills for run of the world at all. And, you know, all the crap that they said about how, oh, this is just an uprising of the people against the government in Syria, I think they really believed that to a great degree. No matter the fact that it wasn't true. I mean, at the very beginning, there was a pretty massive protest movement, but then a bunch of suicide bombers came out, and all those people went home. And that was 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. But I think those slogans really are the result of, you know, the meetings of the deputies. This is what we all agree is going on here, right? Okay, and then this is what we say about it, and this is what we do about it, and then they do it. And they're basically just a bunch of damn Democrats. In other words, they're stupid. They don't know anything. And so, yeah, sometimes America backs Iran, like in the Iraq War, against Al-Qaeda. Sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, like against Gaddafi and Assad in Libya and Syria. Hey, maybe we'll switch back again. Used to back them in Bosnia, and before that in Afghanistan, in Chechnya, here and there. But then again, Obama wants to make peace with Iran. Maybe he'll take the Leverett's advice and make peace with Iran and wage war against the Al-Qaeda types. That would seem to make a little bit more sense, considering who's actually killed American civilians around here and who helped us hunt them before. Helped the Leverett specifically. Anyway. Thanks for another week of putting up with me on the show. Happy holidays. I think I'll probably do a show or two next week. Not sure. But I'll be on Sunday morning on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA if you want to tune in to that for anti-war radio. Otherwise, I'll probably be back here Monday. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe not. Anyway, Happy New Year.